The novelist Tracy Chevalier has made a career of bringing history to life. She's written books set in medieval France, in 18th century London, and in 17th century Holland, specifically in the home of painter Johannes Vermeer. That book tells the story of a Dutch teenager who became a maid in the Vermeer household, and the subject, as Chevalier imagines it, of one of his most famous works, Girl with a Pearl Earring. Well, Tracy Chevalier is back with a new historical novel. It's called Remarkable Creatures, and at its center is a pioneering 19th century fossil hunter named Mary Anning. Chevalier encountered Mary Anning's story one day while visiting a small dinosaur museum in England.
I had never heard of her, and I learned from the display that she was a working-class girl who had lived in Lyme Regis, which is on the south coast of England, and had been fossil hunting with her father. And one day she and her brother discovered a huge specimen of what turned out to be an ichthyosaur, an ancient marine reptile about 200 million years old. Had no idea what it was, thought it was a crocodile, and went on to discover another ancient marine reptile called a plesiosaur. And she was really quite an amazing woman because she was completely self-taught, never had any formal education, was very poor, found these things for a living. And maybe most importantly to me as a novelist, she was struck by lightning as a baby and she survived it and to live to tell the tale. And I loved that. When I found this out, I thought, I have got to write a novel and I've got to start it off with a lightning strike.
And you open the book with the line, "Lightning has struck me all my life, just once it was real." I wonder if you would read a bit of that passage for us.
Sure. "The lightning killed the woman holding me and two girls standing next to her, but I survived. They say I was a quiet, sickly child before the storm, but after it I grew up lively and alert. I cannot say if they're right, but the memory of that lightning still runs through me like a shiver. It marks powerful moments of my life, seeing the first crocodile skull Joe found and finding its body myself, discovering other monsters on the beach, meeting Colonel Birch. Other times, I'll feel the lightning strike and wonder why it's come. Sometimes I don't understand, but accept what the lightning tells me, for the lightning is me. It entered me when I was a baby and never left. I feel an echo of the lightning each time I find a fossil, a little jolt that says, 'Yes, Mary Anning, you are different from all the rocks on the beach. That is why I'm a hunter, to feel that bolt of lightning and that difference every day.'"
So that's the first chapter of your book, the way you open it. And again, this was real person, Mary Anning, who really did survive a lightning bolt. And to be clear, this is a book set in the very first part of the 19th century, the early 1800s.
Yes.
This is, a couple of generations before Darwin was writing Origin of Species. And what she was finding, you know, the scientists were still really trying to understand the very concept of what a fossil was.
That's right. It was prime Jane Austen territory, if you like. It was early 19th century. Most people believed that the world was 6,000 years old and it had been created by God in 6 days and set to run and was exactly, if you looked around, it was exactly as God had made it. They took the Bible as literal history. And their scientists were very slowly starting to question that. And when Mary discovered this specimen of an animal that clearly didn't exist now, first they called it a crocodile, but they really quickly realized it couldn't be because it has this huge bulbous eye like a donut, and it has paddles rather than claws and legs. And they quickly figured out it was an animal that was extinct, and that was like setting off a little bomb and this cozy idea that the world was 6,000 years old, because suddenly people realized, actually, the world isn't just as God had made it. There are animals that have died out that have gone extinct, and that was a very new concept.
So Mary Anning, as she hunts for fossils on the beach, you write about how she would look at these things and she felt a sense of wonder and of awe at what she was seeing, but she didn't really understand it. The other narrator for your book and the other central character is a woman named Elizabeth Philpott, and she did understand it a bit more. Tell us about her.
Well, Elizabeth was like a little gift to me as a novelist. When I started researching about Mary's life, I kept hearing about this woman named Elizabeth Philpott, who became a very good friend of Mary's, and they used to go out fossil hunting on the beach every day. And Elizabeth was 20 years older than Mary, a middle-class woman who had moved with two sisters down to Lyme Regis from London in 1805. And they never married, and they became quite interested in fossils. But I thought Elizabeth was perfect because when I was looking into Mary's life, I thought it's going to be very difficult to tell this story only from Mary's point of view because her point of view is necessarily limited because her experience is limited. She hardly ever left Lyme Regis and she never had any formal education. And so I needed a voice. I needed somebody who could in a way be the reader, standing, watching the person who's the genius at work and commenting and thinking about them. So it's a book that becomes about more about their developing relationship. It's about fossils, but it's also about friendship. And in a way, this book tries to answer that question, what do women do who don't find the Mr. Darcy of the Jane Austen novels? What do they do when they don't get married? What is there for them in this society that expects them to marry?
Mary Anning, not someone that most people will have heard of today, certainly not before reading your novel. She did leave one legacy, though, that lasts, and that's something that may be familiar to children, a saying that you discovered, was based on her.
There is a tongue twister. She sells seashells by the seashore. And I think that was created in 1908, supposedly as a tribute to Mary Anning, who sold mostly fossils, but she did indeed sell seashells by the seashore. And the funny thing was, I was originally going to name the book She Sells Seashells, and then I thought, there's no way I'm going to do that because I'm going to have to say it so many times that I'll never be able to do it.
Do you feel any pressure from having had such a huge success with Girl with a Pearl Earring relatively early in your career, knowing that you're going to have a really big audience no matter what you write? A lot of people will read it.
I'll tell you what I feel pressure most is getting things right. Most people aren't going to read a biography of Mary Anning or read scientific books about her. They're going to read this novel and they're going to think that's exactly how it happened. I had that feeling after I wrote Girl with a Pearl Earring. People took it as if that was what really happened with Vermeer the painter, and that's how the painting came about, when actually I made most of it up. And I had no idea that the book was going to have the success it did. And so afterwards, it was a real shock. And ever since then, as I write books about things that really happened, I have to be very careful. So I definitely feel the pressure of being, in a way, like Mary Anning's representative, and I need to get it right as best I can.
Tracy Chevalier speaking to us about her latest novel, Remarkable Creatures. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You can read an excerpt from the book about the discovery that launched Mary Anning's career as a fossil hunter at our website, npr.org.
Our next guest wants to tackle what he considers a huge challenge in healthcare, the effort to get really smart people to remember essential things.
Atul Gawande is a surgeon and he's a healthcare writer. His articles sometimes get passed around the White House. He's focusing on the complexity of medical treatment. Gawande says American doctors might save money and lives if they used a checklist.
It's just a rundown of best practices for treating anything from back pain to cancer. Atul Gawande's book, The Checklist Manifesto, includes the story of a man who came to an emergency room with a stab wound.
He had perfect blood pressure. It was a single wound about an inch in size in his belly.
Probably didn't look that bad.
About 10 minutes later, he crashed, lost his blood pressure. And when they got him open, they found that the wound had gone, this is a pretty big guy, and had gone straight through more than a foot into him, all the way into his back, and sliced open his aorta. And so afterwards, they asked a few more questions of the family. How did this happen? Well, it was a Halloween party. Well, what exactly went on? And then they learned that the guy who stabbed him was dressed as a soldier carrying a bayonet. And if they had understood it was a bayonet, they would have thought about it quite differently.
And so it seems, in retrospect, very simple step. What was this man stabbed with is a step that was not followed. Somebody made one too many assumptions about this.
Yes, and this is why that case was interesting to me. Our great struggle in medicine these days is not just with ignorance and uncertainty. It's also with complexity, how much you have to make sure you have in your head and think about. There are 1,000 ways that something can go wrong. we miss stuff. We are inconsistent and unreliable because of the complexity of care. And when I looked at other fields and how they handle complexity, again and again, they come back to this simple idea of just using a checklist.
Well, let's make a comparison here. How does the way the average doctor work compare with the way the average airline pilot works?
It was very interesting. I got a chance to visit Boeing and see how they make things work. And over again, they fall back on checklists, as people know. The pilot's checklist is a crucial component, not just for how you handle takeoff and landing in normal circumstances, but even how you handle a crisis emergency. We only have a couple minutes to make a critical decision. In surgery, the way we handle this is we say you need 8, 9, 10 years of training. You get experience under your belt, and then you go with the instinct and expertise that you've developed over time. You go with your knowledge. What we found is that when you have them use a checklist, when you have them turn to that reminder, that bedside aid, we get better results, massively better results. We brought a 2-minute checklist into operating rooms in 8 hospitals. I worked with a team of folks that included Boeing to show us how they do it. And we just made sure that the checklist had some basic things, make sure that blood is available, antibiotics are there. And we caught basic mistakes in some of that stupid stuff. But then the second part of it was we also found that good teamwork required certain things that we missed very frequently. So on the checklist is make sure everybody knows each other's name in the room. And the average reduction in complications and deaths was over 35%.
Just from missing basic things. And I love that thing about teamwork, knowing the other people's names, just being sure that the doctors are communicating with the nurses who may be in the room at that moment.
Making sure everybody knew each other's name produced what they called an activation phenomena. The person having gotten a chance to voice their name, speak in the room, were much more likely to speak up later. If they saw a problem.
Well, being questioned on a mistake is another thing. How do surgeons that you know respond to this notion of being questioned by their colleagues and having to refer to some simple or elaborate checklist to make sure they got everything right?
When we first brought in the idea of a checklist into operating rooms, you can imagine the response. The predominant one was, we already do this stuff. We don't need it, and this is a pain in my butt. We asked them to give it a try. And when we surveyed people afterwards, there was about 80% who thought this was something they wanted to continue to use. But 20% remained strongly against it. They said, this is a waste of my time. I don't think it makes any difference. And then we asked them, if you were to have an operation, would you want the checklist? 94% wanted the checklist.
What, if anything, in society at large makes people resistant to this notion of relying basically on memory aids or reminders when they're doing a complex task?
Partly, I think we have a hard time admitting weakness. And one of the things that we have to grapple with is that we have to assume we are fallible, even as experts.
Although that's not the image we see in TVs and movies, is it? I mean, you see the heroic pilot flying by the seat of his pants. You see House hobbling through the hospital and coming up with another brilliant diagnosis out of the back of his head somewhere.
In my last chapter, I grapple with one of the things that struck me about the miracle on the Hudson when Sully Sullenberger brought the plane down that saved 155 people after it was hit by geese over Manhattan and landed it in the river. Over and over again, we wanted to say, look at this hero who piloted this plane down. And the striking thing was how much over and over again he said, there was nothing that hard about the physical navigation of this plane. Instead, he kept saying it was teamwork and adherence to protocol. And when you walk your way through, and I did it, I walked through all the things that the team did, what Jeff Skiles did in the jump seat to try to restart the engines and make sure that the flaps were in the proper position for the landing and so on, you realize how much of a team effort it is. I come out of my operations, and then I go out and talk to the family, and they say, doctor, thank you for saving my husband. And you feel a little bit like a fraud because you know how much you were dependent on everybody getting this right. And when we acknowledge it, that's when we come back to ideas like checklists.
Have you made yourself a better surgeon?
I didn't expect it. It's massively improved the kinds of results I'm getting. When we implemented this checklist in 8 other hospitals. I started using in my operating room because I didn't want to be a hypocrite. But hey, I'm at Harvard. Did I need a checklist? No, I didn't.
You didn't think so. 20%.
I was in that 20%.
You said no.
I have not gotten through a week of surgery where the checklist has not caught a problem.
Atul Gawande is the author of The Checklist Manifesto. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Paget Powell's The Interrogative Mood, a novel, is a book like none other. It's made up entirely of questions. Some are laugh-out-loud funny, and some leave you pondering the meaning of life. But for all the questions it asks, the book has many readers asking, is it really a novel? And the book's subtitle, A Novel, suggests that not even the author knows for sure. So NPR's Lynn Neary asked him.
The narrator, or should we say interrogator, at the center of this book, is someone of a certain age. You can tell this by some of the questions that he asks, like this one, about a soda that has long since peaked in popularity.
Do you miss Tab, and do you fully understand its disappearance?
The interrogator is nostalgic about the past, and one guesses not entirely pleased with the way things are in the present. He's definitely a guy. That's clear from any number of questions he asks, some of them not meant to be discussed in polite company. And he has a wicked sense of humor. But this is a funny guy of a certain age who also seems to be contemplating his own mortality.
Do you want something said of you or nothing said of you when you go?
This guy can make you smile one second and send you into a private reverie a moment later.
Have you done any mountain climbing? Would you eat a monkey? What broke your heart?
So who exactly is this man of many questions?
Well, let me use some of my rich French. C'est moi. Why be coy about it? That's me.
Paget Powell is both the author of this book and its only character, though Powell says he never really thought of this book as a novel. He began writing it in response to some emails he got at the University of Florida, where he teaches. The emails posed a series of questions which annoyed Powell. He decided to come up with a response.
I sat down and wrote, "Are your emotions pure? Are they the stuff of heroes or the alloyed mess of the beaten? How do you stand in relation to the potato?" And it was a lot of fun. And I kept going and woke up at some point in some horror that I had about 142 pages of this.
Powell was hailed as a literary genius when his first novel was published in 1984. He's written half a dozen novels, but traditional fiction no longer really interests him. There's no real narrative structure in The Interrogative Mood. Powell's love of language and the nature of his obsessions is revealed through the questions themselves and through his odd juxtaposition of the whimsical and the profound.
There's lightness and then there's gravitas, and they're coming in cycles and in rhythms. So those things are constituting a kind of substitute for narrative in the squarer sense of that word.
At first, the book seems like a quick, breezy read, but then some of the questions insist on being answered. The interior dialogue that results can be surprising.
Do you regard yourself as redeemed, redeemable, or irretrievably lost? Do you find that the flavor butter pecan, as in butter pecan ice cream, sounds better than it tastes? What is the loudest noise you have ever heard?
I confess that upon opening it, I did think, is there any possible way that a meat and potatoes reader is going to be able to get through this book?
Novelist Rick Moody reviewed The Interrogative Mood for bookforum.com. Moody says as soon as he started reading the book, his fears that it would be too forbidding vanished.
First and foremost, it's hilarious. You know, that's all true. But it's also great that, as in all Paget's work, what's funny and what's deeply moving and deeply sad are all cheek by jowl. So the second you find yourself chuckling and going, oh, that's a good one, you know, then the next question is, you know, some lacerating bit of self-engagement that really makes the whole thing lift off the page for me. And that's how you make the emotions stick in fiction, is to have them all mixed together like that.
Moody says it doesn't matter whether you call it a novel or not. That's just a way to sell the book. Instead, he calls it a bit of a masterpiece. As for Powell, he says he's been amazed by some of the reactions to his book of questions.
It's very odd. People are reporting strange things. I had a guy write me very early after the Paris Review excerpt saying that he read the excerpt to his new girlfriend and had her answer all the questions, and he wanted to thank me because he thinks he knows her a lot better now. And I thought, well, what have I done? What have I got here?
Just a couple of more questions to contemplate. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.